From KUOW, it's The Record. I'm Steve Scherr.
And I'm Ross Reynolds. Seattle's Museum of History and Industry has just opened a new exhibit called Revealing Queer. It's a showcase of the lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, intersex, and queer community, or LGBTIQ, here in Puget Sound. Producer Amina Al-Sadi and I went to Mohai earlier this month to get a tour from the co-curator of the Revealing Queer exhibit, Erin Bailey.
We have a language panel here.
These are squares with different names on them. Sex, sexuality, gender.
And then it goes down to LGBTQ and explaining a few terms that are used in the transgender community, as well as some pejorative words that we argue aren't the best ones to use anymore. And the idea is that you would see the word and you would flip it up.
So under sexual, it's sexual attraction and experiences, sexuality.
And then if you go under, one of the other ones I think is really important is to go under F to M, which is a common term used
for female to male.
Transgender, which means female to male. And then it gives you a definition of what that means, which is refers to a transgender person who is assigned female at birth but identifies as male. And this will allow people to kind of go into the communities and talk to people who identify as LGBTQ in a really intelligent way so that they feel empowered to talk to you in an effective kind of way. Because a lot of these words, people are afraid of being politically incorrect. So they don't want to say, Erin, what's queer? Which some people still do, which is great. And then we have a really rich conversation about what queer means to me and what queer means to other people. But this allows them to have kind of the starting block to build their own understanding of it and to introduce them to concepts and topics they might not know.
Erin Bailey, co-curator of the Revealing Queer exhibit at Mohai. If you'd like to check it out, it's going to be there through July. While we were at Mohai, we also had an opportunity to sit down with Marcia Botzer. Marcia is the founder of the Ingersoll Gender Center here in Seattle. It's an organization that supports and advocates for people who are transgender. Marcia is one of the pioneering advocates of transgender rights in the Northwest. Nearly 50 years ago, when Marcia herself was questioning her identity, there were not many, if any, resources in Seattle to turn to. Marcia was inspired and moved by the labor and social movements of the 1960s. It was in Europe in 1968 where she first started to find some answers.
Oh, I remember one night in San Marco Square in Venice. Sitting with a group of other folks, fell into conversation, and I heard from someone who knew someone, quite literally this is true, who knew someone, who heard about someone who had a friend who may have made a gender transition. At that point, I took the thought, I'm not the only one, which is a cliche now, certainly in the transgender world, but so often that was the case. We thought we were somehow the only ones having these feelings. Well, when I heard that, I tucked it away, and when I came back to the States a couple of months later, I started to call around because it was just embedded in me that the way we do things is we call up counselors or we call something like that, and I got no answers. People said they didn't know what they were doing. So,
what were your questions?
Oh, I don't feel right. I don't think I'm a boy, you know, and people, the kind ones would say, well, I just don't know anything about that. The others would say, well, I can't help. Goodbye. Very, very difficult to deal with. So I returned to the working world and made attempts over time to connect with some kind of help. Finally, goodness sakes, it hit me that if it isn't in the world, what did I learn from that labor time? What did I learn from Paris? What did I learn from all that? Then we make it ourselves. But I looked around, I had no idea how to do that. And it wasn't until I encountered the folks at Seattle Counseling Service, it's represented here, the oldest LGBTQ counseling service in the country, possibly the world, who knows, that it really began to be possible that there might be something that would answer my questions directly.
When was this about?
That was in the late 70s. Yeah, and I encountered some excellent work that was being done there in Seattle Counseling Service.
Well, in the meantime, how are you kind of dealing with it in your own life?
Not well. There just was nowhere to turn with that kind of a question for me, other than these attempts I've mentioned to contact professionals. There was a nascent and difficult program at the University of Washington for a short period of time that I did hear about, but it was impossible to connect with.
Well, aside from professional help, how about just people in your life, your family, your friends?
Oh, I wouldn't tell a soul. You know, if you've heard the stories of the lesbian and gay individuals who fought so hard and hid so deeply because there was nothing else to do, there is a similar pattern, at least for me. One of the gigantic differences between then and now is that there are so many individuals, especially in a city like this, where that's not the case anymore. But it sure was for me, so I didn't tell them.
So you're trying to get some recognition of what you were going through, and it sounds like meeting a lot of frustration in that effort, but then you did.
Yeah, it's life is like that, isn't it? I mean, it doesn't just really come at you full-blown and complete. It sort of slips in the back door, and that's pretty much what happened. But there were support groups and forms of that kind of work going on at Seattle Counseling Service. I met some other folks who did, in fact, identify as transsexual. That was the word we had at the time. We didn't even have the word transgender yet. And that's how it got going. And I began to do more work with that. And by the early 80s, it had coalesced. Well, actually, the late 70s, it had coalesced in my mind to create a center that would respond to the needs of people like myself and people facing gender identity questions.
And that became the Ingersoll Center.
It certainly did. It certainly did. As I said, I'd gone back to work, and I used to hang out at the library all the time because, goodness sakes, with these thoughts in my mind and everything else, there wasn't much. I just couldn't get going on anything else. And there was a book one day on the table in the library. It said Ingersoll on it, and I thought it meant the compressors, you see out there. So I opened it up, and it was Robert Greene Ingersoll, a great free thinker from the 19th century. And his first essay just captured me. So
Did it have to do with sexual identity?
No, nothing. And as far as I know, he never spoke on orientation or identity issues at all. No.
What about what he spoke to you?
Oh, my goodness sakes, Robert Ingersoll. Well, his free thinking is probably why I don't hear about him so much anymore. But he spoke for the rights of women and children. He spoke on civil rights. He was incredibly eloquent about belief systems and why, in most cases, they must be challenged. In those years, he was 1833 to 1899, so you can imagine what kind of response he received. But he was apparently quite the orator because he spoke to more folks prior to microphones, so I'm told by researchers, than any other citizen of the States. I mean, he was all over. But that doesn't really matter so much as what he said.
Yeah, well, is there something that he said that kind of sticks in your mind, phrase or...
Yeah, I'll bet, yes, indeed, there is. I often include it in my comments with folks I'm working with, and it's this. The time to be happy is now. The place to be happy is here. And the way to be happy is to make others so.
So?
To make them happy. Yeah. Now, we might not say make in our age, but what he was obviously saying is that let's help each other. That's a great source of happiness. And it is.
How is Ingersoll different than these other things that were going on that were paying some attention to these issues?
Well, it took the concept of a support group, which in those days and today as well, is a welcoming and safe space where you can come in, you can talk for a few minutes about what's going on in your life. It took that concept and made it 100 times safer, and 100 times more heard. In other words, we would train group leaders and facilitators to listen incredibly carefully and incredibly passionately to whatever the individual was saying, because we really didn't have much language for all this sort of experience. And those groups became the heart of Ingersoll's work, and they still are. All these years later, we still do those every Wednesday night. We haven't missed one in what? Well, in all these decades, we haven't missed a Wednesday.
This was brand new. What are some of the things you learned from this deep listening about how to work with people?
Well, it's really nothing surprising. It's pretty simple stuff. People will appreciate being heard not just for a moment, but deeply and fully for a few minutes of their lives. They may not have that time anywhere else in their week, but they could come to us and they would have it with us. And it's gone on and on now. Today, we still do support groups on that order, but we sometimes will begin with everyone together, and then groups break out to face special questions like family issues or male to female or female to male or genderqueer. Or we have employment groups now. We even have a thing called Team Hack, which is for the folks who love to make little electronic things as part of our employment project. But all that was in the future.
Was it difficult for you to kind of come to terms with that before you opened the Ingersoll Center and tried to work with others on these issues?
Well, I think it's an ongoing process, especially I've talked to so many, and they're reflected on the walls around us right now in this museum, so many of the early organizers around lesbian, gay, bi, and trans stuff. And we all say the same thing, that we were learning as we went. We were listening to each other, trying to make sense of all of this. Since then, now we have mountains of evidence-based medicine. I'm part of an international organization, so on and so forth. But we didn't have it then. We had the feelings.
Sitting here in an exhibit called Revealing Queer and talking to you about 30 years of the Ingersoll Center, Marcia Batzer, one might think that it was pretty much a straight line from 1962 when you're questioning, and a straight upward path to where we are today. Was it as linear as that, or were there sometimes two steps backwards?
Oh, goodness sakes, not at all linear in many respects. From the early 60s to now, in terms of Ingersoll, for example, you know, the flag that is on the wall here, we used to call it our old battle flag because we carried it in every parade and all that sort of thing. It's not what we use anymore as our main flag. But it's there because a great fellow, Pat Butler, a good friend of mine, a gay man, he and I sat one night. We talked about, what are we going to do? We want this banner. And he sewed it up. He sewed it up over a few days, and there it is. But even what to put on a banner is my point. We were unsure of, and we went back and forth and so on and so forth. What kind of language to use? There's been a great deal of discussion worldwide about what kind of treatment, especially Western world medical and psychological treatments, should be available for transgender people. And some of them have been very rigid, like requirements to live 2 or 3 years full-time in the gender role to which you are moving before you could even receive any kind of hormonal care or something like that, which make no sense. And yet, at the time, the thought was, well, we just don't know what's going on, so the powers that be would impose these kind of positions as the best thought of the moment. Well, it's been a struggle through those kinds of things. So on the care level, that has been a tremendous and ongoing struggle. The latest issue of the Standards of Care by the World Professional Association for Transgender Health, that's the international guidelines, evidence-based medicine, that folks use. The last version 7, has the amazing line in it that transsexual, transgender, and gender nonconforming people are a diversity, not a pathology. And that's coming from the medical establishment.
What's that mean, a diversity?
It means it's not sick. It's not crazy. It's not evil. It's not sinful. And it's not bad. It is just who you are, and how are we going to deal with that so that you can get on and be the very best you can possibly be? Uh-oh, I'm getting going here. But that's the idea.
When you look at here in Washington State, in Seattle, where do you see things needing to move toward where they are not yet?
Yeah, where to go? That's an excellent question. Immediately comes to mind health. Access and availability, huge issues. And access, of course, contains issues like class. For example, how do you pay for it? The new healthcare system, very helpful, but not clear at all yet what it will mean for transgender people. Those kinds of things need a lot of work. Policy needs a lot of work, so that it isn't just the Fortune 500 that have policies, and they do, for transgender transitions, but it's every other corporation around that has them, that every school has policy, that there is no place where a trans person needs to be afraid. I mean, that's a big order. It really is. So we've got a lot of work to do there. We really do.
Marcia Batzer, founder of the Ingersoll Gender Center. We also heard from Aaron Bailey. We were speaking at Seattle's Museum of History and Industry in South Lake Union because they've got an exhibit there called Revealing Queer that's up through July. From KUOW, this is The Record. I'm Ross Reynolds with Steve Scheer.